You're listening to The Takeaway. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. In late July, the World Health Organization declared monkeypox a global health emergency. And according to the latest numbers from the CDC, there are now more than 5,000 confirmed cases in the U.S. Much of the reporting on monkeypox, which some researchers are now calling MPXV, has focused on high transmission rates among men who have sex with other men. And despite all of the lessons we might have hoped officials had learned in earlier parts of the COVID-19 pandemic, the rollout of MPXV testing and vaccinations has been haphazard and uneven. At the same time, more than 430 people per day are still dying of COVID-19 here in the U.S., with Black, Hispanic, and Native American people still being about twice as likely to die from the virus. See, viruses are more than pathogens, and surviving them depends on more than physical health.
My name is Stephen Thrasher. I'm the author of The Viral Underclass and a professor at Northwestern University.
In The Viral Underclass, Thrasher upturns simple biological notions of vulnerability, pointing to the social determinants of health. So who is the viral underclass?
The viral underclass is composed of people who are affected by different kinds of viruses, sometimes with extremely different characteristics, but it keeps affecting the same kinds of communities. So we've seen in the last three epidemics that are most on my mind, HIV/AIDS, coronavirus, and monkeypox, for instance, you know, we're seeing a very disparate impact on the LGBT community, particularly on gay men, men who have sex with men. And HIV behaves very differently from COVID. But even COVID, which is a respiratory illness, had a disparate impact on LGBTQ people because of the ways that transphobia and homophobia make LGBTQ people marginalized in society. We're poorer, more likely to be unemployed, more likely to be homeless, less likely to have health insurance. And so whenever any kind of pathogen in the world is moving, it's more likely to hit us, even in ways that might be a little counterintuitive. But in the book, I'm trying to work through how there are dynamics to a viral underclass in many countries around the world. But there's a particular way in the United States where viruses themselves make people economically downward mobile. You know, it makes people more likely to be poor. And that's not true in every country in the world. But I was just reading an account of a person who got infected by monkeypox and broke down crying because their doctor told them they would have to quarantine for a month. Unpaid. And in the United States, we let infection happen to somebody and then cast them into the economic pit and say you're on your own to get help. Even if you're forced not to work, we're not going to help you out economically. And so viruses themselves become a way that people fall down the economic ladder in the United States.
All right, I want to go back for a second because I want to be certain that we're clear about this question of the likelihood of being affected by an infectious disease. The claim that you're making here is about the social determinants of health rather than a claim about sort of biological vulnerability.
Correct. So we often focus on the moment of transmission because that's sometimes the most visible. And it's a time where sometimes we can put a physical barrier for, you know, instance, a condom or a mask of something of that kind can stop transmission right there. But that's only one step in a chain of events that happened before and after. And so I'm really interested in these social determinants, the ways that racism, ableism, homophobia make people vulnerable, make their bodies more likely to be in the pathways of viruses, but also to become infected when they encounter them. For instance, one thing I'm thinking about in the book is the ways that we barely give children sexual health education in this country. Many states only give them an abstinence-only sexual education, but we generally don't give children an LGBTQ sexual education. And so when young people are becoming sexually active and then coming into their adulthood, they don't know what to do. And because we haven't given them the information they need, we are putting their bodies in the pathway of viruses in the ways that they're more likely going to enter their bodies. And I think that's a real failure of the state and society in making particular populations vulnerable and then getting angry at them and economically punishing them and stigmatizing them after that happens when they've been failed by the society even before the moment of infection.
much of your previous research has been around HIV. You write in the book about the maps of New York City and your realization about the COVID maps and the HIV maps. Can you say more?
When I first was seeing deaths happen from COVID, and I was here in New York when things locked down and the deaths started to be reported, the first person in my outer social circle was an activist named Lorena Borjas, who died of COVID-19. And she was a trans Latinx immigrant rights activist. And I started looking at the maps of where she died and where the hospitals that were in Queens and Jackson Heights and some of the places in the city where the deaths were rolling in. And they were very similar maps to the maps I'd seen with HIV and AIDS. And in one sense, this was counterintuitive. These viruses behave very differently and the transmission is different. But what they share in common is that there are dense concentrations of poor people, people of color, trans people, people who have been marginalized by the society. So when you look at the places in the city where transmission and deaths are happening across a variety of viruses, they're kind of similar. And a lot of that has to do with the social determinants of health. If you're the kind of person who sees a doctor regularly, or who, you know, in the case of COVID in particularly, can afford to work from home, you're going to be less affected by the virus. And one of the things I'm trying to drill down into this is I think many Americans have a misperception about gay people. You know, they might think of LGBTQ people as being rich, but queer people and trans people are overall poorer than others. And in New York City, for instance, a huge percent of LGBTQ people work in retail. So that's one of the reasons why you would see a disproportionate impact with a respiratory virus that might not seem so obvious. And then when you get into viruses that involves the way that we're intimate with each other, and you look at the social determinants, the lack of education, the lack of queer and trans specific healthcare, the outright attacks on queer and trans health and well-being, it makes a lot of sense about why we see certain people in the viral underclass across a variety of different viruses.
And yet the book begins in a place that might seem even more surprising. What does all of this have to do with police violence? You actually begin the first chapter with the murder of George Floyd.
A lot of people don't remember, or maybe they never even knew, that when George Floyd died and there was an autopsy on him, he had the coronavirus. He was living with it. And I've thought about that a lot, even at the time. I wonder, you know, had he survived that encounter, would he have gotten seriously sick or died from COVID? And I also looked at the budget for the city of Minneapolis, which spends 36% of their money on policing. George Floyd had recently lost his job, as 40 million people lost their jobs in those months in the beginning of the pandemic. And so I think about, what if Minneapolis hadn't been spending so much money on policing, but rather had been spending money on housing and care for people like George Floyd so that they could survive the pandemic? He never may have ended up in that store and in the path of the police. And so the prison abolition movement and the movement to try to defund the police, I think, has a lot of interest from a wide variety of society when they think about what things are we spending money on the police to do that someone else could do. And so if we understand, if you spend more money on public health, if you spend more money on housing and giving people what they need, particularly in economically hard times, you don't have to spend so much money on police. And the more money we spend on those, we're not spending on other things. And so I'm very concerned right now that the Congress under President Biden and a narrow but still a majority in both houses of Congress, they failed to pass their last $15 billion bill for COVID care. And what they lost in that was funding to pay for people who don't have insurance to get testing and treatment. And research has long told us that people who don't have insurance are the most likely to get COVID, get sick from COVID, and die from COVID. So the lack of this money is basically letting people get sick and die from COVID, the people who are the most vulnerable. And so I think we're really failing as a society to see that, you know, you can't stop people from getting infections and diseases with a cop with a gun. You know, that money is going somewhere else. If we spent more money on public health and well-being, we wouldn't be needing all this money for cops. And the spending of money on cops creates situations like the one that killed George Floyd.
Can you sort of tease out the ways that
privilege and this notion of immunity from or safety from infectious disease is connected not only in COVID, but in these previous plagues as well.
I write about the myth of white immunity. And there is a certain level of structural immunity by being born white on average, better predetermined areas of health. You know, many have educational and economic and wealth tools that many non-white people do not have. But like all forms of immunity, it has its limits and is not absolute. And one of the ways we've seen quite poor and decreasing metrics of health in the United States is among white people. Jonathan Metzl writes about this, who wrote the foreword for my book. He writes about this in his book, Dying of Whiteness, that you will have a lot of states, you know, particularly in the South, that are rejecting Medicaid expansion because they say they don't need this at a time where white mortality is rising. White people are dying at younger and younger ages. And so I try to write about it in the book to say that there are ways that there can be cross-racial, cross-ethnic solidarities among people all around the country to try to create better health outcomes for everyone. And one of the things that's stopping white people from partaking is their belief in this white supremacist and the idea of their own immunity. This is a big part of why I think we had the birth of the anti-vax movement, which came through upper-class white people in California, sort of believing my child, you know, their immunity is so superior, they don't need a vaccine because their bodies are so much better than other people. And of course, that puts their children at great risk. It puts other people at risk. The case at the heart of the story is about a young Black man who had HIV, and he's accused of transmitting it to several white men. And those white men often engaged in unprotected sex, believing somehow that they were protected when they're not. And I think that's a lot of how we see people not using masks, you know, ways that we see people not taking the things that are happening to them as seriously as they should. And in my research, this is really dovetailed with looking at how HIV moves through the use of injection drugs. And injection drug use is just one area where we see how the opioid crisis plays out, how we see how deindustrialization is having an effect on white bodies in Appalachia and states in the East and the South. And so if you think something's not happening to you, if you have a belief in your innate immunity, then it becomes not only difficult to help yourselves, but it precludes opportunities for solidarity with other people. And so even people who think they might be immune to these things have a lot more in common with the viral underclass than they do with the ruling class that is threatening to put all of us in an underclass if we, you know, get sick with any one thing and fall off a financial cliff.
We have to take a quick break. More with Stephen Thrasher just ahead on The Takeaway.
The archives at Carnegie Hall hold treasures from our cultural history. In the new podcast, If This Hall Could Talk, we use these items as touchstones to explore how the past shaped the world we live in today. I'm your host, Jessica Vosk, and I'll be joined by historians, performers, cultural critics, and others to look back at the iconic venue's legendary and sometimes quirky history. If This Hall Could Talk, from Carnegie Hall and distributed by WQXR. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Back with you on The Takeaway, I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, still talking with Professor Stephen Thrasher about his new book, The Viral Underclass.
Most of us in the United States are socialized to think as consumers, not as citizens of a society with collective health responsibilities. I could get on planes easily and fly anywhere I could afford in the world, with little thought to how that choice affected the asthmatic Black and brown children living near the airports I departed from and arrived at, whose lungs inhaled exhaust from the jets ferrying me around, or how the carbon footprint of my travel would affect wildfires in California or Greece. Why did I need to think of their bodies when I thought about flying? I was free to do whatever I chose with my body, as long as I could afford the price of the ticket.
Stephen told me what it was like for him, as a longtime researcher of the HIV epidemic, to see Dr. Anthony Fauci become the face of the COVID-19 pandemic.
Anthony Fauci has been around for a very long time, and I was too young to be cognizant of him in the early years of AIDS, but I certainly know him from history, that he was a very central figure at the beginning of the AIDS epidemic in the United States. And he's largely been beloved by liberals now, but he was really criticized and pushed by a lot of gay activists at the time to help push him to do more and to help speed up processes of things that happened and not take a, you know, quote unquote, sort of neutral observer standpoint. And it was surprising to me just to see that one person would hang on for this long, but also it's been concerning seeing how a kind of cult of personality around him by liberals puts too much emphasis on one person. And whether we're talking about social justice work, people leading movements, or individual medical practitioners, the things we actually need to think about and enable are systems. You know, any one person is not going to make things better or worse by themselves. And it's been very dismaying to see that the Biden administration, having said what they said as they were running for office against Donald Trump, they have not changed a lot of the systems that perpetuate viral illness. You know, the fact that we're still such a carceral nation, that Biden wants to spend money on hiring 100,000 more cops, that we still don't have paid sick leave, that we don't have a national healthcare system. These are the things that drive viral pandemics. And so in some ways, you know, even though Trump was an absolute cartoon of malfeasance with this pandemic, if you have sort of a more calm, ameliorating figure like Biden in office, if you have Fauci working between administrations, it's actually less to do with any one personality than it has to do with how we're handling systems and allocating resources. And that way, it's been really disappointing, even seeing with this new administration, despite their going quite out to get people vaccinated initially, they have not had a long-term commitment to the things that make people ill. And that's one of the reasons why we still have so many thousands of COVID deaths happening every week.
I was worried about you during the early months of the pandemic, my friend. And then as I read the book, learned that that worry was perhaps well-placed because you write about your fear of infecting others being just overwhelming. Can you tell us more?
Yeah, and I remember when you reached out, and I really appreciated that. It was really tough. I feel like in the pandemic, people who lived with families and had no space to be alone suffered a lot. And people who lived like myself alone suffered a lot. The people I knew who did the best lived with other people, but in housing where they could, you know, everyone could kind of get their own space when they needed it. But it was extremely painful and lonely. And being able to write about what I was going through was both helpful, but also bewilderingly scary and frightening at times. I had to learn how to live without touch and live without seeing people very often. And as you know, I was very afraid of making somebody else, you know, infected. And I've had that fear again with monkeypox. I wrote a piece that's going to be out later in the week from The Guardian about the ways that my life as a gay man for many queer people is both about negotiating my own risk, but also thinking and worrying about infecting other people with intimacy. But the realm of intimacy with COVID, of course, extended to just breath. And that was an extremely difficult and painful thing to navigate. And as I was writing the book, I did take a lot of solace from the people I was writing about who showed me it's not easy work to do, but it's important work to do, that there are ways that we can navigate being intimate with one another, understanding this reality, and that maintaining our human connection to one another, despite this biological reality, is extremely important. The primary purpose of life is not just to keep the economy running, it's also to be connected to one another. And viruses have taught some of the people I write about really well how to negotiate that. But it requires admitting a level of vulnerability and a level of humility that are at odds with so much of how American life is presented. And it's not easy, but it's really important work to do.
You do end on a hopeful note as you write about what we can learn, right? Viruses being teachers, and writing, quote, viruses have the potential to help us make a world predicated upon love and mutual respect for all living things. Are you still feeling some level of hope?
I feel right now extremely concerned about monkeypox and sad that some of the lessons that we should have learned were not enacted. I don't think that we're done learning what we can learn from any of the viruses that we've interacted with, there's still the possibility to learn from them. I just hope that it happens and that we act on what we learned sooner rather than later before it takes more people's lives. And, you know, I really love Miriam Kaba's phrase that hope is a discipline. It's something that you work at. And so there are times I feel really tired and I think about some of the queer people that I know and, you know, we're tired. it's hard going through this over and over again, but, you know, it has to be done. And so people are rising to the occasion and doing the work that they need to do. But it's really hard when you realize, okay, community groups are mobilized. People are ready to get vaccinated. The federal government just doesn't have the supply. So that makes it very difficult to feel hopeful. But in terms of people having learned at an individual level a lot from this pandemic and being able to draw upon the people that they loved who were affected or were lost in this pandemic, there's a lot of power that we're living in a time in human history where everyone on the planet has been negotiating the same issue sort of at the same time, with the ability to communicate about that. And some good things are going to come out of that shared process.
Stephen Thrasher is the author of The Viral Underclass, The Human Toll When Inequality and Disease Collide. He's a professor at Northwestern University. Stephen, thank you.
Thank you so much, my friend.